Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment. Master Commissioner Robert Mayer presiding.
Please be seated. There are four cases on the oral argument calendar for this morning. In a discussion with counsel before this session started, it was agreed that all of these cases can be argued on a consolidated basis. What we have are numbers 2013-1710, 2013-1826, 2013-1827, and 2013-1828. And so at this time, Ms. Gorey, if you'd like to present the argument.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Kelly Gorey of Rich and Gillis Law Group, here on behalf of the appellants, Auglaize County Board of Revision, County Auditor, and also Wood County Board of Revision and County Auditor. I thank the court for the opportunity to come before it today to present what I think is a fairly important issue. Quickly on the facts of these cases, all of these cases were filed by non-attorney property tax consultants called Tax Compliance Services. Their attorney, Mr. Awadalla, signed the complaint, I believe, in all of the Wood County cases. And for the Auglaize County case, I believe Mrs. Ginter signed the complaint herself. Subsequent to the filing of the complaints, Mr. Awadalla or Tax Compliance Services provided a few documents. Most of those were available online and included the auditor's transfer page from its website and also, excuse me, portions of the auditor's website, a Zillow printout. Zillow is usually a residential online service. And for the Auglaize County case, there was a portion of an unsigned settlement statement attached to the complaint. In all of the cases, the owners and their attorney were properly notified of the BOR hearing, and in all four cases, no one appeared for the hearing. Having no persons to cross-examine regarding the alleged transactions that occurred, and also no admissible documentation, each Board of Revision dismissed all of these cases for failure to prosecute. The appellants or Tax Compliance Services appealed to the Board of Tax Appeals, and I then moved to affirm all of the cases for failure to prosecute. And the Board of Tax Appeals in each of its decisions indicated that because the property record cards disclosed a sale of the property, that the dismissal was improper, and not only reversed the dismissal, but then remanded back to the Boards of Revision and directed the Boards of Revision to take the sale prices at issue. We then appealed to the court. And as I see it, there really are three distinct legal issues that are before the court today. The first being whether or not the Board of Tax Appeals reversal of the failure to prosecute was proper. The second being whether or not the Board of Tax Appeals can, in my words, usurp the original jurisdiction of the Board of Revision and direct the Board of Revision to take a value rather than remanding to have the Board of Revision issue an original valuation decision. And then the third, which I think is probably the most important, is whether or not the Board of Tax Appeals lawfully applied a presumption of value to a sale reported on a property record card for which there was no appearance of any, of the owners and personally involved in the sales to testify regarding the sales or their arm's length nature.
And did the whatever documentation was presented with the complaint, did it demonstrate that these sales occurred? Well, when in relation to the lien date?
The oldest of the sales was actually 33 months prior to the lien date, which was the Chow case, I believe.
Okay.
And those were the sales from Fifth Third Bank. And then the other sales, let's see, the Auglaize County occurred in 2010. The other Chow cases occur, or I'm sorry, sales occurred in 2011, and then also the Fannie Mae for home and rentals was in 2010. So we have various times from 3 years to...
And the lien date is January 1st of 2010?
2012.
Oh, 2012.
Yes,
okay.
Correct.
So all of the sales, or to the extent that they're in evidence, occurred before the lien date at issue?
Correct.
And so for at least some of them, there was a period of time when the auditor carried whatever was being carried on the property records and decided not to use the sale to value the property.
That's correct. In fact, 2011 was a reappraisal in Wood County.
Okay.
So the Wood County auditor would have had those sales before it and decided not to use those sales. Mm-hmm. And one of those reasons being is that it's the position of most auditors, and I think they're correct, that the Ohio Administrative Code prohibits them from using a bank sale as a sale that can be used in their database for a mass appraisal or also as the true value of the property. I understand that's up for debate, and the BTA has certainly held that that regular, as I call REO sales, can be used as evidence of value. But you will see most auditors and most mass appraisers not relying upon an REO sale or a Fannie Mae sale as evidence of value.
And certainly in the first instance, it's the auditor's duty and discretion to decide how to deal with
absolutely
what's on his or her records in terms of how to assess in a particular year.
That's correct. That's correct. And some counties, when a sale takes place, they will send a one-page sheet to the buyer, usually, to ask the buyer questions regarding the sale. Mm-hmm. Some counties do this, some counties do not. And that's why you will see the notation, particularly on the Auglaize County property record card, that the sale has not been validated.
Okay.
And Auglaize County, I believe, does send verification sheets, but the unvalidated would either mean the auditor doesn't consider it to be an arm's length sale, or no one submitted the form back to the auditor.
Now, in none of these cases is the actual conveyance fee statement in evidence.
No.
Is that right?
Neither the conveyance fee statement nor the deed are present in any of these cases. In the Wood County cases, all of the information was available online regarding the sale. There's no evidence that the owners participated with their attorney in this case at all. For the Auglaize County case, we do have the portion of the unsigned settlement statement, which that would have had to have been obtained from the owners.
Let me go back to something you said at the outset, that the complaints were filed by some sort of a service that holds itself out to file complaints for owners.
Yes, correct.
But a lawyer was involved in...
A lawyer was involved in the signing of the complaint.
Okay.
You'll note in the record for, I think, two of the cases here, Tax Compliance Services did participate at the BTA by responding to my motions, but didn't exactly sign their name. Their fax number was present, and I think maybe they contacted the BTA perhaps on one of my cases. So they have participated at the Board of Tax Appeals level. In none of these cases have the actual property owners participated at all.
Let me ask you this. I mean, obviously when the BOR is confronted by a situation such as the one in this case, it arguably has a choice between dismissing for failure to prosecute or simply retaining the auditor's value based on a finding that there's insufficient evidence to require a change.
Correct.
And here, the BOR dismissed for failure to prosecute.
Correct.
Why would it not have been a better disposition to simply say we don't have enough evidence leave it at that?
That is a great question, and there are counties that simply never dismiss for failure to prosecute, and then there are counties that prefer to dismiss for failure to prosecute when no one appears. Obviously, if an owner or a representative appears at the hearing, they won't dismiss for failure to prosecute. Mm-hmm. But in this case, as no one appeared, and both their attorney and the owners were duly notified of the hearing, the BOR elected to dismiss for failure to prosecute. As we noted in our brief, it is the result is exactly the same.
The result is the same, but I guess I'm wondering whether in this, to some degree, you outlined what your arguments are, whether or not the standard of review on appeal is somewhat different if there's a discretionary aspect to the dismissal, whether or not there's a threshold issue of whether that discretion has been abused and so forth. I mean,
I think there is a discretionary aspect to failure to prosecute. In the court's cases, the first cases really discussing the failure to prosecute are the Swetland v. Evatt case, and that was actually in 1941. But the more recent cases are the LCL income properties and Leach. And in both of those cases, the court held that when a property owner fails to appear and does not submit any evidence, the Board of Revision is within its discretion to dismiss the complaint for failure to prosecute. And the Snavely case is where the court refined what is the difference between a failure to meet your burden of proof and the failure to prosecute the complaint. And there, the attorney actually appeared on behalf of the owners and submitted evidence at the hearing. And in those circumstances, the court said it was unlawful for the Board of Revision to dismiss because there was a person that actually appeared at the BOR hearing.
I guess there's some reason to be concerned, isn't there, that whether or not the taxpayers are on notice, you know, it's one thing to be given notice that you have the opportunity to appear and present your case to the BOR. And it might be another thing to be given notice that if you don't appear, your case is going to be dismissed for failure to prosecute. Might that be a reason to say that in a situation like this, the BOR ought to address the merits rather than dismiss, or does it matter?
Well, our position is that by failing to appear at the BOR hearing, the Board of Revision is authorized to dismiss. There actually are some Boards of Revision that indicate in their hearing notice that if you do not appear, that your complaint will be dismissed.
Is that true in this case?
I will have to look.
Well, that's all right. I can take a look.
Our position regarding the dismissal is whether or not they dismissed or they would have done a no change because of 5715.19G, because the owners didn't appear at the BOR hearing, they would have been prohibited, absent good cause, from introducing new testimony at the BTA that could have been presented at the BOR. Our position remains that when an owner who is duly notified of the hearing and its representative does not appear at the BOR hearing, the BOR is authorized to dismiss. And I want to discuss a little bit about the presumption. We believe that there simply is no authority whatsoever for the Board of Tax Appeals to apply any presumption of value to an owner who files a complaint based upon its own sale and then fails to appear at the hearing. This court has noted in many instances over the years that a presumption of value is created and arises when a Board of Education files with the BOR or the BTA a conveyance fee statement and a deed. I was unable to locate any case in which this court has ever said directly that a property owner presenting a conveyance fee statement and a deed at the Board of Revision is entitled to any presumption of value. We do have the 1997 Cincinnati School District v. Hamilton County Board of Revision case where the court discussed that a presumption of value can apply to a property owner, but that was where the owner filed the complaint based upon its own sale. The court, in the facts, it's unclear whether or not the owner actually showed up at the BOR hearing, but the BOR did take the sale in that instance. And the Board of Education appealed to the BTA. And there the court said the owner was entitled to the rebuttable presumption that the sale price constituted true value, but those circumstances are very different than what we have here. We have the Board of Revision rejecting the sale price, and we certainly have no testimony whatsoever from the property owner at the BOR hearing. And the Board of Tax Appeals now is using the recent case of Mason City School District to support its position that the notation on a property record card creates a rebuttable presumption of value. As this case was just introduced, and it is not in a couple of my briefs as they were filed before the case was decided. That was one of the reasons why I'm here today, was to talk about that case. Very different situation in that case. It was the Board of Education relying upon a sale price. The Board of Education indicated on its counter complaint that the property did sell, and when the Board of Revision granted a reduction to the property owner, the Board of Education appealed to the BTA. And instead of submitting a conveyance fee statement and a deed, like it would ordinarily do, the Board of Education failed to do that in this particular instance. And when the case was appealed to the court did hold that the BTA was justified in finding that a notation of a sale on a property record card is a sufficient evidentiary basis for the existence of a sale. It would be our position that this case should not be extended such that a notation on a property record card creates a rebuttable presumption of value.
Yeah, my recollection is an unusual case, and everybody was sitting together at the hearing and
yes,
agreeing that the sale had occurred.
Exactly.
And so forth.
Right. And the owner's representative appeared at both the BOR hearing and the BTA hearing. The appraisal that was presented by the owner discussed the sale. The owner's appraiser discussed the sale. I believe it was the court's position that essentially any right to deny the existence of the sale had been waived at the BOR hearing by the owner consenting basically that the sale existed and it was such that it was. And the court certainly did not go on to say that that created any presumption of value. And in fact, in that case, the court actually remanded to the Board of Tax Appeals to allow the new owner to present evidence to negate recency. So it's our position that Mason does not support the BTA's decision in this case, and also that RC 571303, which is the auditor's duty to value property, as of 1/1/12, this did contain the mandatory shall, that the auditor shall use the sale price to value property. But if we look at the language in that statute, it is an arm's length transaction between a willing seller and a willing buyer. And we have no facts here to support that either of these sales at issue were arm's length. So it's our position that neither case law nor the statutes help the BTA in this instance. Okay. And just one quick comment on
go ahead and take your time since there's basically four cases.
Okay.
You would otherwise have an hour. So.
Okay. Well, I just
appreciate if you don't
thing.
Take an hour, but.
I will not take an hour. I just wanted to discuss a couple of public policy reasons why the Board of Tax Appeals' decision should not stand in this matter. When a reduction is granted by the Board of Tax Appeals, the reduction, the lost value has to be passed on to the rest of the taxpayers in the taxing district. So when a Board of Tax Appeals unlawfully and unreasonably grants a reduction in value that is not proper, essentially the tax loss has to be passed on to the remainder of the taxpayers in that taxing district through the reduction factor. And that the reduction factor is when each year the Board of Education is not allowed to receive less taxes than it did the year before. So when we have the Board of Tax Appeals granting reductions on all of these sale prices, where had the owner appeared and testified and the sales are not arm's length, that loss has to be passed on to the rest of the taxpayers in the taxing district. And the second one, which I think is equally as important as the first, if not more important, is that the BTA is actually rewarding owners for not appearing at the BOR hearings. So we have a situation where had these owners appeared, maybe we would have discovered that these properties were not listed on the open market. Maybe we would have discovered that it was an auction, exactly like in the Cincinnati case, that the documents indicated that it was a foreclosure auction. That would be a sale that's not an arm's length sale. The intent, we believe, of the certainly of the statutes is that it's mandatory for the BOR to hold a hearing in this matter. They have certainly a mandatory duty to hear and investigate all complaints. And when the auditor's value is the default valuation, the BTA is essentially saying the property owner is in a better position to not attend the BOR hearing. And we believe that simply cannot stand because it's always the owner's burden to depart from the auditor's original valuation. The BTA is essentially saying every sale is reported on the property record card is an arm's length sale. And every sale has to be the best evidence of value. But that's not really what the statutes or the court have ever said. And so you have here, I think, definitely encouraging fraudulent transfers. We could have, in my mind, if someone is willing to attempt to manipulate property value for their taxes, they're probably equally as willing to not correctly fill out the conveyance fee statement. And one of the examples in my brief was that an individual property owner forms an LLC, it's the sole member, it conveys the property to itself, and on the conveyance fee statement doesn't check related parties. The auditor reports the sale on the property record card, and the owner files a complaint. Well, the owner is in a better position under the BTA's decision if it fails to appear at the BOR hearing, because the BTA will require the BOR to take that sale. If the owner appears at the BOR hearing and testifies, well, actually, I am the only owner in the LLC. I am the sole member. That then is a related party transfer that does not qualify as an arm's length transaction, and the BOR would be justified in not using the sale price as the best evidence of value. When we have a statutory scheme that provides that the auditor's value is the default valuation, the owner bears the original burden of proof, as the court held in LCL, it's simply not too much to ask to have the owner appear at the hearing and testify regarding its own sale. And one quick note on the, and I, we did touch upon this in our brief, that there's, we believe, a large difference between applying a presumption to a Board of Education and applying a presumption to an owner. The presumption works well and makes sense to apply it to a Board of Education because they're not involved in the sale and have no access to the sale documents. They can't present any evidence essentially to rebut or prove that the transaction is arm's length because they don't have the evidence. A property owner does. When it files its complaint upon its own sale, it should be a reasonable procedural requirement for them to appear at the BOR hearing and testify regarding the sale. The presumption works for the Board of Education because they have no way, they have no access, particularly at the BOR, to any of the documents that would potentially show whether or not the sale is arm's length. And let me see. I think that may be all I have, and our position would be that the Board of Tax Appeals acted without basically any semblance of authority in these cases, and that the, at a minimum, the cases have to be reversed to, excuse me. And if the court would find that the dismissal for failure to prosecute was not proper, the case should be remanded back to the Board of Revision to have it issue its original decision on value. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Gorey. Unfortunately, there is no one to rebut your arguments, but these cases will be submitted to the court, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.
Thank you very much.
All rise.